The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchin.
And me, Lachlan Bloom. For those of you listening to this podcast for the first time, this is part of a series where we talk to fellow authors about their process and technique.
So this is episode 27 and we were joined by the novelist and longtime poet, Caleb Claesis. Caleb joined us in Senate House on a nice crisp February day. Caleb, a little bit of background. His poetry collections include Bottled Air, which was published by Eyewear in 2013, and the pamphlets All Safe, All Well, Flare Stack 2011, and Modern Version, If a Leaf Falls 2017, and Fatherhood, the novel he has out with Prototype Press, which came out at the end of 2019, and is sort of largely the base of what we were talking about, being that I don't know how you see yourself, but I am a complete sort of non-expert when it comes to poetry, something that I seek to remedy.
Yeah, I think it was interesting to hear Caleb talk about turning poetry into prose and the process of sort of editing and translating the ideas from a poem into a novel.
Mm-hmm. There seems to be quite a lot of elements of crossover and things that are very distinctive between that.
And yeah, we also sort of veered off into AI and the future of writing as well towards the end of the podcast.
I feel like you're obliged to say the dystopian future.
Dystopian future of writing.
I mean, I for one welcome our new artificially intelligent overlords. Anyway, here's Caleb.
Well, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
On the way from York to Birmingham.
Yeah, that's right.
It's not a stopping point for sexual endeavor. But you're based up in York.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I've been there since 2014. Yeah, I was just saying that, like, now coming to London, it's like the first year probably when it doesn't have like a certain kind of tang, do you know what I mean, to come here, a certain nostalgia. Now it's just a place.
Yeah,
that's okay. Yeah.
And you teach creative writing.
I do.
In English. And is that, with your teaching, more of a focus on poetry or prose, or is it mixed? Because we should say first off that you might want to speak about this, your sort of background initially is poetry, perhaps more than prose.
Yeah. Yeah. So up until this point, I'd published almost exclusively poetry. I'd published some nonfiction, and a couple of short stories, but that's about it. So this is definitely the first work of extended fiction. And at the university, I teach all sorts, actually. I don't even specialize in poetry, really, because it's quite an open undergraduate and master's degree. So people are writing all sorts of things, and I'm just kind of responsive to that.
And was there a decisive moment that you sort of switched from poetry to prose, or have you been writing prose all the time and this is the first piece that's been published?
Okay, so there's sort of two answers to that question. One is that there was definitely a decisive moment. And I think there was a decisive moment when this book kind of hinged from being a poetry book to me knowing that it kind of had to be a prose book. And that was the point, I think, at which there was a sort of internal necessity generated by the material in the book to kind of have a momentum, to have a drive, which it, as a poetry book, just kind of didn't have. I liked what I took to be the kind of intensity of it, but it was like stuttering into some kind of arc, you know. It was neither one thing nor the other, I think. Which can be exciting, but in this case it wasn't. And then it was very definitely like a summer of kind of writing through the material with a narrative. The other answer to that question is yes, I have got a novel in a drawer that's never been published that I wrote before this, and so I did, and which I came to see as something of just an apprenticeship in narrative. And some of the kind of things that then felt slightly more available to me when I wanted to do that with this book.
Mm. So do you generally feel you have did you have lots of fragments or lots of standalone poems that when you stood back and looked at them, you thought that these need to be, I have this narrative arc and they need to be prose, and then you went back to the drawing board, so to speak, and rewrote everything. Is that a common process in your writing, that you kind of write something, stand back, and then change it around completely, maybe change the form, change the structure? Or was that quite a unique sort of realization that, oh no, this is going to be something different? I thought it was going to be these X number of poems, and now it's not, and that's not happened before.
So it was exactly that, basically. Yes, it was a collection of discrete pieces, some of which all seemed to be pointing in the same direction, some of which kind of, I was in denial about them having their own lives and wanting to do other things. And that is a very common challenge for me. I'm always... the form is something that's like always in kind of flux for me, I think. Something pieces are constantly like on their way somewhere else. And so it was actually the discovery, I think, this time was exactly that, stepping back and realizing that there was a necessity for something to pull everything together. And for that to be quite a simple frame, probably the simpler the better, to allow all these things to have somewhat of a kind of their own integrity as pieces, but you know, people need something, right? People need, and that, so that was a revelation for me, which I hadn't quite done before, I don't think.
Yeah. When you're working with a collection of poems, and they end up being a collection with a sort of thematic link or anything, is there anything, I'm asking this as a non-poet, is there anything in terms of how you plan to put those pieces together in the same way that you put a novel and the themes that would run through a novel together? Is there a sort of... Because it's something I've always wondered about. When I read a collection of poetry, obviously, generally, if it's just, you know, someone, a currently practicing poet, it won't have dates or anything. So I don't know when they came together.
So there are different organising principles, aren't there? And I think there was a sort of older idea that you would put dates on, because the idea was to show a sort of poet's development, and that was it was almost like tagged to a person's life, and so a collection was merely a kind of snapshot of their development at any one time. That's less prevalent now, I think, and I'm always in awe of poets who do have a kind of begin with a particular concept in mind and then work through that, a sort of recipe. And that sounds pejorative, but I don't mean it like that at all. I think of, like, I don't know, Sam Rivier's Kim Kardashian's Marriage. Do you know that? Which is, the whole thing is kind of based on various features of Kim Kardashian's marriage. 77 days, 77 poems, you know, all of those things. Or Rebecca Tomash's Witch, all these kind of witch poems, spells, and various different kinds. I've never worked in exactly that way. I think I tend to have a sort of period of writing and then pulling out and then writing and then pulling out and kind of being able to see more clearly what things are appearing. And the operating principle of the novel then becomes time, narrative time. But yeah, you don't have that in a poetry collection. And so it might be something much more intuitive about a kind of arc of feeling, perhaps, or... certain concerns grouping together, maybe.
So there aren't really parallel or exact parallels in the selection of material. I sort of wondered if that sort of thread might work for both your poetry and for the prose.
No, I think they're quite, in my experience, they're quite different. Yeah. Yeah.
So you're not, with the poetry, with the collection, you're not really looking to create an explicit narrative or anything explicitly connecting the poems, especially with the prose, you set out to have an explicit narrative arc that tied it all together.
Right, exactly. And that's partly to do with the way I've read poetry. So I very rarely read a poetry collection front to back. I just sort of go in and rummage about. And I mean, unless the way in which it's set up explicitly is kind of telling me to do something else. Whereas you don't really do that with novels, or at least it feels extremely naughty to do that with a novel. Yeah. And so, like, the idea that a novel, it has to, you know, somebody will go away from it, and when they come back, they kind of are sort of where they were. Whereas with a poetry collection, they might be starting somewhere else, or they might or they might immediately be taken somewhere else. And I love that about poetry, but that's not what I wanted with this novel.
Yeah, I think there is something I'm more familiar with novels and prose, but there is a sort of switch, it feels like, almost. Sometimes I come back to a book that I got into, but for whatever reason have not read for like a long period of time sometimes. And I can get back in when I find the bit I was in. I've forgotten anything that had happened in the novel, any of the characters, but a couple of pages, all the action and the whole sense of the novel comes back, and it's, you know, stored somewhere, obviously, all in that interim period. But
I don't know. Sometimes I make myself go back to the start. If it's been long enough, and I feel like I'm not getting the threads, which is really disappointing. It's 200 pages, but. Commitment.
That is commitment.
I mean, now that I have a young child, that perhaps will stop happening. It's like that life is too short.
Yeah, I mean, if I come back to something and I don't get what I don't remember anything of it, then I kind of think, yeah, it's a sign.
That's exactly what the author intended by this point, for me to completely forget everything that was previously in it. On the subject of fatherhood, that's what we were interested in talking to you about. I mean, it's an obvious and very on-the-nose thing to ask about with relationship to this novel. But I was sort of interested in, and we don't really need to unpack exactly how autobiographical it is, but whether, because it plays such an important role in your novel, whether it was a response to how you were feeling about childhood or the sort of new experience that you had, or were you already working on bits of it and suddenly that came in and gave it another narrative thread?
No, I wasn't. No, it kind of hit me on the nose as well as, you know, it was very much, and for the first time, a response to what was happening to me. It felt like the world kind of come to me rather than the other way round. And initially, actually, I was so aware of the kind of dominating presence of this thing in my life that I wanted to write something in order to get it out of the way so I wouldn't just write about it all the time. And the exact opposite happened, which is that I started writing about it, and then it, you know, it took on attraction of its own, and it also started to sort of complement and affect the way I was living. So there was quite a sort of dynamic relationship between this kind of emerging fiction and then the way I was thinking about my life. It was like a way of thinking. Mm-hmm. It became a way of thinking, I think.
And did you find the process of writing prose sort of straightforward? Like, once you had the initial realization that these poems need to be translated into prose form, did the process of actually writing that become fairly straightforward? Did you have sort of a block of time every day that you devoted to writing and you just get so many words done, or was it more a case of trial and error and not like, oh, this is something new, this is different from writing poetry and I don't really know what I'm doing? And
so I suppose it's partly conditioned, as all writers' lives are, by the kind and quality of time that's available to you. So the academic year, which I became an academic, if that's what I am, at some point during this process, and so entered into that particular calendar, right, where you have, in my case, two quite intensive semesters and then a summer, which is much more available to you. Although, of course, that's slightly truncated by childcare and, you know, other things that I was trying to pay attention to because I wanted to look after children, but also write about them. And so I think that the poems are in some ways more a reflection of the kind of intense bursts of time that you might get in a semester. And then the novel was knitted together really quite quickly in a couple of months over one summer. And actually that was like just like a really joyful and quite relieving kind of process. It felt like once I'd found a way, it was quite smooth.
And was it a case of you felt you kind of had the content, so to speak, in the poems, and it was more a case of joining the dots and almost an editing process rather than a writing process, rather than a creation process?
Yeah, exactly that. And I think if you convince yourself that that's the case, then so much pressure is taken off, because the kind of hard work has been done of kind of generating the actual material, and then you can just kind of knock it into place.
And is that something you would recommend for other authors or for your next novel? Is that an approach that you think that works? I would try that again, or just in those circumstances at that time, it all came together. But in retrospect, you think, no, next time I'd start with chapter one and write the novel.
Yeah, but I mean, I've always been so attracted to that idea of starting with chapter one and just working your way through. But I haven't been able to do that. I mean, there was a lot, you know, a great deal of angst and difficulty up till that point. And it was partly because it then switched that it was so. And I think some of the pleasure, I hope, which may be communicated in the novel, is the pleasure of that writing, right? Is the pleasure of that just coming together. So it is a potential model. I don't know how relevant it is to anyone else who kind of might have such materials. I know I'm beginning to write another novel, and I'm writing it quite differently. I'm writing it very much in standalone sections, because I'm quite aware of my own tendencies. I'm writing it almost in kind of short stories, which can then be combined, I hope, at the end into a novel.
So this time, in contrast, you're kind of not starting with any narrative arc in terms of the novel writing process. So with fatherhood, you had the poems and had the realization that there needs to be an narrative arc, and then the novel was sort of born. Whereas this time you're, I guess, in a similar way, starting with fragments or short pieces. But
I think the difference is that I'm interested in how short pieces might have their own narrative integrity, which you then might place together in a certain way that they then have resonances with one another. I'm like really interested in novelists like, Thomas Bernhard, for example, who kind of obsessively go over certain motifs, and that kind of becomes the sort of narrative when the narrative is like incredibly simple in a book, and how you might have certain pieces which have their own kind of vibe, but then they kind of share, I don't know, concerns or even share kind of literal details, which then build to something else. At least that's what I'm trying to do.
And is that something that you feel just comes naturally from your concerns and your thoughts, or have you sort of written short pieces that you started thinking, oh, this could be a chapter or some part of the novel, and then you got to the end of it and think, no, that the vibe of this piece now doesn't fit with what the rest of them, even though it's something I'm interested in, I think it stands alone, but it doesn't fit with the overall piece? Or
there's an interesting psychological thing which I'm slightly embarrassed to admit, but I think sometimes I go 90% with a piece, and then I become a bit afraid that that's exactly what's going to happen, and then I leave it and go on to somewhere because I then will come back once I kind of know, you know, if I know then that it does have a place, then that's when it will kind of take its fullest expression. And if not, then it might go somewhere else. But it's almost too painful to finish it.
But that makes sense as well. The finishing it, whatever.
Right,
whatever
exactly.
That means, maybe that time away is, you know,
yeah.
Doing quite a lot of the work, maybe in your unconscious. And are you, for structure, so I guess we can go, the meat and veg of this podcast as well then. How are you planning this? Because this is a different approach. For the sections you're working on, are they kind of just fragmentary notes that you've got, or have you got a sort of scheme that you've planned out, or are they coming to you as they come to you? What's the...
Interesting, just now talking to you, realize how conditioned it is by time. But I think what I did was, over a few months, I just had a massive document where I was just putting in notes, diaries, quotations, all those sorts of things. And then
a Word document.
Just literally a Word document. I work a lot with notes on my phone as well, as increasingly people do. And actually, a lot of fatherhood was written like that. And then I realized that there were certain things that were emerging from that. And then I spent the summer writing a huge chunk of words, but just not worrying what might happen. And then I started cutting that up into manageable sections, which felt like they were real stories in their own right. But that was only from quite an aimless, but extremely enjoyable process of just writing it out.
And within that Word document, do you have any sort of structure, or is it just that as a thought occurs to you, write a line, 10 lines, a page, and then close the Word document? And
pretty much, yeah. And that was conditioned by just what time I had. And I'm a morning person, so a kind of 3-hour block in the morning is basically my kind of basic unit.
Yeah.
And so that it's whatever happens in that time, really.
And is it? Do you have any kind of phases within the time? Do you have a sort of period of weeks or months where you're purely generating stuff? So that 3-hour block is, you don't look at anything that was created the day before. You just open up, start putting down words that have occurred to you since your last sort of session writing, or do you kind of also jump back and forward editing and at that phase? Or phase, you may not have phases of writing versus editing, or
and I really should emphasize how how unprogrammatic this is. I mean, it's just totally a kind of feeling for whatever might be happening at any one time, and a kind of sense of what might be possible. I don't think I did look much back, and I was consciously trying not to edit too much when I was just compiling that kind of what felt like a kind of source book for me to use. Partly because I know that I have I do this with students' essays. I'll just proof they read their essays, and I'm like, what are you doing? You know, I don't need that. And I do it with my own work, and you can get into, it's like you're polishing your own notes. So yeah. Why are you doing that? And you also, I think, can lose some of what's raw and surprising and difficult about what you might do if you don't kind of go back at that first phase, for me anyway.
I really like to hear that you're a user of this kind of sprawling Word document. So I think you're the first writer who says it, and this is exactly what I do.
Oh, right.
And I think I'm sure other writers do it, and people just have felt that it's too formless to talk about. But I think that I find going through it, sometimes you want to add something, and you need to find a place. It just doesn't make sense to necessarily put it at the bottom.
Yeah.
And that's where you start to work things out. So it sort of fits between here and here, so... I'm glad that that's not just I'm a really ill-disciplined sort of hack who's just trying to throw things into a Word document and think, it's my idea pot. And do you sort of write every day with it? Are you sort of disciplined about writing, and whether that's the writing or editing process?
I am quite disciplined, but it's not always possible to write every day with a teaching schedule. I think there was a couple of, probably from doing a master's in creative writing which was about 10 years ago now. And from then on, I got into fairly good habits, I think, of just being kind of trusting that it was possible to sit down every day with a coffee, that it's possible. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That's like the default for me, at least. And so, yeah, when there's time, that's what I do.
And with the editing process you mentioned earlier about sort of proofing your notes as well.
Yeah.
Have you, because I suppose, I don't know what this means really, but I have this idea of the sort of the poet's eye. Do you really intensively edit as you're going along before you move on to the next section? Or do you sort of get it down and then go back and revise?
Yeah, well, I think for Fatherhood, because it was poems. So actually, I mean, much of the book had already been published by the time it was published. And so, yes, those were very, very intensively worked over pieces of writing. Sometimes to a fault, in that they, you know, certain things can take on... Their kind of contours are too hard to then integrate. You know, they have their own kind of jagged edges because you've kind of filed them right down. And so I'm trying with this, knowing that I'm wanting to write something which is more or less prose. I'm trying to hold off on that. Mm-hmm. Because I know how difficult it can be to integrate things together which have too much their own kind of shapes.
Do you find that process easier or just different from writing poetry? I guess it's sort of less sculpture involved in a way, like less working and reworking. And is that something that you have to kind of fight against? Do you kind of read a page of prose and think, oh, kind of itching to cut away those words and really boil it down to the essence, poetical essence? Or do you kind of think, oh, this is kind of like a weight off my shoulder, I can just read this and be with the narrative rather than having to worry about that side of things?
Yeah, I think I have to constantly remind myself of what it is that is going to kind of pull somebody through a piece of prose and would pull me through a piece of prose if I was reading it, because my temptation is for the beauty and the interest to be in the patterning, or in those mm-hmm. other kinds of formal aspects which are not necessarily what I'm now interested in. So it is much, and also I can make things entirely collapse. I can make a piece of prose totally collapse under its own prissiness. On the other hand, without having some of that, I can also, it's very difficult to keep aloft a plot, you know? So it's somewhere in between, right? I mean, it's always somewhere in between.
Do you find that the teaching is a useful sort of input to your creative output? Does going through more sort of early works of people, does that help? Or is that something that your brain just has to work in a completely different way? I realised that I'm asking this question and you're employed as
teaching. Yeah, I know.
But I'm just interested in whether there's an interference from that or not.
You know, I in a seminar yesterday, I said, look, I'm doing a podcast tomorrow, because they'd read some of my book, and I said, what should I say? And they just had nothing for me. So they give nothing back. nothing back at all. Is it useful? I think...
I mean, I guess my question really is, if you're spending the day being really... Or I don't know how marking sort of works necessarily with it, but you're going through trying to pick out things and be really constructive, but you're being critical, and then you need to sit down the next morning and be creative. I wonder if there's a sort of clash between that, really.
You know, it's really difficult, because I really want to say that there isn't, but there is. I think there is. I think it's different. It's the gear shifts that you have to make are are difficult, I think. And I wish they weren't, but they are. I think that's partly because people are at all sorts of different levels and you're trying to work out how best to help people. And that involves setting various different kind of contexts that you're always trying to think about. And then I sort of think it's difficult sometimes to then remember what kind of context you're working in. I don't know if that makes any sense. Probably not.
Do you find yourself ever sort of writing something and then deleting it or moving away from it because of an urge of something you told students, no, you can't do this. This is really bad form. Then you do something along those lines and think, I better not do that. This is what I've been telling people not to do. But in actual fact, you know, that can be a part of the creative process to break the rules.
Right. So I constantly come up against, as a teacher, these two kind of equally powerful impulses, right? Which is, on the one hand, the impulse to just say again and again and again, it's all about freedom and it's all about exploration and it's all about, you know, breaking down whatever barriers there are to anything. On the other hand, I think you do have to get a sense of what those barriers are and of what the inheritance is in order to know what it is that you're kind of pushing up against. And sometimes in the academy, we're in the kind of strange position of encouraging people to resist things that they're not even aware of. And so sometimes students don't know how radical they're being, right? So, you know, I talk to my students and they don't know what The New Yorker is necessarily. They don't know what a short story is. But they read this kind of incredible sort of formless mass of text that's floating around on the internet, which is actually a kind of potentially really radical way of thinking about what a text is and what authorship is. But they don't necessarily know that because you're constantly flipping between trying to set up a sense of what has been while also trying to set up a sense of challenge to that. And sometimes that can become like confusing for me as well as I hope it isn't too confusing for students, but yes, that can certainly, weirdly enough, I think I've actually learned more through teaching about some of the more basic aspects of kind of craft, you know, which is essentially a sort of American invention of the mid 20th century, I think, which have been extremely useful, but things that I didn't kind of that kind of came in like after I started teaching, which is a strange process.
Do you have any examples of that? Is that putting you really on the spot?
Right. So for example, fatherhood does follow Freytag's pyramid. Right. Have you come across this idea? So this is the kind of American screenwriter's idea of plot, where you essentially, you know, Aristotle's three acts, you kind of overlay inciting incident, which then goes up to first climax, second climax, and then a kind of denouement. That sort of like triangular version of a plot. I did find that very helpful to sort of as a kind of grid for working through what appeared to me quite formless material, right? But it's also just like incredibly stifling sort of generic way of working, if that is...
Yeah, if you kind I of think it's in the context of the book as well. I mean, I don't think anyone would read Fatherhood and think, oh, here's someone who's been to screenwriting 101 and they're clearly just trying to write another Hollywood blockbuster. Having that framework in your head, obviously... It helps and accelerates certain ways of writing.
Yeah.
It's sort of useful to... Yeah, I think, as you were saying before, it's useful to know it even if you're not going to use it. Because when I did my creative writing course, Robert McKee's story was one of the books that was sort of recommended. Mm. It's sort of like... I mean, it sounds really... try to say you want to know the rules if you want to break the rules.
Yeah.
But I think that there's...
No, yeah. But that's exactly... I think that cliche is true.
And if you understand how
true.
That structure works and you think, okay, that's how I could plot something that's a sort of satisfying way of doing it, then you can go and subvert that far more securely than...
And I think there will always be a few people who just... Some seem to come out of nowhere and they don't... It's not that conscious and it's just... They just... And I have had some of those students, but for most people, I do think that that cliche, it just does, is true, mm-hmm. right? Yeah.
But you'd say that was fine for, say, music or painting. Right. And so that, I feel it's odd that we get a bit, or I feel slightly embarrassed and awkward about speaking about writing in that way, because maybe exploring writing in this way and the practice of writing is quite a relatively new thing, especially.
And I think it's the canvas of writing. I mean, the canvas of music, say, is broad as well, but there is, you can't really argue with the sort of mathematics of musical scales, and there's a certain sort of underpinnings of how sound travels and works that, I mean, the mechanics of writing, I think, are not, you can't apply them the same, although there are sort of broad mechanics of what people respond to, but it can be about anything in any style, mm-hmm. in any way, in any format, in any, it's like going back to what you were saying about the internet now just being a stream of words. I think that has changed a lot of the ways that people understand story, and you know, a story can be in a WhatsApp conversation, whereas go back 200 years, it was more organized within sort of systems within society that have now been broken.
Right, and that's wonderful, you know, and the kind of lack of gatekeeping on and the kind of access people have. Although there's also, of course, this, you know, the totally insidious side to that, which is that you kind of have computers which are writing the stories that people are kind of, you know, can't differentiate from any other story, and that's.
I'm interested in that then. Yeah. So this is something I've seen in an article about probably in the last week about AI production of novels and things.
Yeah.
And I think so, maybe it was on the radio or something. Someone was saying about how would it affect how you felt about the novel if you found out it had been written by a computer, which I think is an interesting question. But what I'm more interested in is, do you think that a book like Fatherhood, for example, a computer's just, with the best one, and I'm thinking that a program has to be programmed to start off with, even with sort of artificial learning, I can't see how a computer is ever going to come up with something like that without thinking that because of the subversion of rules that we're talking about would mean that the computer would reject out of hand some of the things that we're doing. So
it's something I've been thinking about quite a lot recently, because I've been writing a film with an artist which is kind of about this. It's a sort of attempt to tell the history of human storytelling kind of on the cusp of this like AI revolution. And I have been, she sent me this this website where you can put in some text and then a computer will just start writing from where you put in, based on what you put in. And you know, I put in like April is the coolest month, you know, the beginning of the wasteland, and it comes up with the text, which is like, it's like high modernism, but it's like got the whole internet's mind, right? And so it's like, it's kind of got these ancient Muslim scholars, like, but also kind of strange, like weather reports, you know, it's like, and it's incredible, right? But it's also kind of meaningless. And so it's right on that border, which often poetry is, between nonsense and sense, right? And you can't, I'm really interested in those kind of like Emperor's New Clothes moments, you know, it's like, what is this? What am I? And so that was a real revelation, because it did make me wonder what the other side of that is. So what is it that you could write that could only be written by a human? Because I think there's one way in which you can kind of wade into that and say, okay, I'm going to try and collaborate with these computers. There's another way which you think, well, what is it? What is it really?
That's brilliant. Yeah, it's like an essential thing.
Yeah, or even, yeah, or just like, what's like not imitable.
Yeah.
Right, in some, yeah. And I don't know where that comes from.
Presumably everything is, because, I mean, any novel is just words, and ultimately ones and zeros if it's in a Word document.
Right.
Like, there's nothing that you can, like, you couldn't just take a text and 100% know that it was or wasn't written by a human. I mean, if it's gibberish, I mean, even if it's gibberish, you don't know it's not a human that wrote it.
No, and it might be wonderful gibberish.
Yeah. But then, is there a difference between the gibberish that a human would produce and a computer would produce?
I mean, I guess at the moment there are differences, but presumably as the AI gets better, those differences will be harder and harder did a tech.
Yeah, I guess maybe I'm looking at it the wrong way, but I'm thinking that, I mean, you mentioned Thomas Bernhard earlier, and I'm thinking, oh, well, a computer would just never think to do that.
I guess it doesn't then, think to do anything.
Yeah,
it
exactly. Just,
but then actually...
And if it can sort of teach, if it can take on new sort of rules and new ways of doing it.
And actually, Thomas Bernhard might be weirdly imitable because it's so distinctive, right? So there might be a few particular rules, like no sentences below a certain length, repeat. So it might be the great stylists who are actually more imitable.
The most sort of phrase.
And I think it's interesting, the idea of how you as a reader respond to it as well, because something like fatherhood, I think you'd have a different sense of having been deceived if you read that and then were told that actually that was written by an AI. It has no concept of fatherhood or anything, but I had an emotional connection with that, but it didn't come from a place that the author, because the author was a machine, it didn't have a chance. Whereas if you saw, I don't know, Mission Impossible 9 and you were told that was written by an AI, you'd be like, wow, that was a really good film, I enjoyed it, and it had emotional points in it, but it doesn't really make any difference if it was written by a machine or not. I don't feel tricked. They did it well. Good work,
so
machine.
I think you can probably read the emergence of autofiction as partly a response to these kinds of pressures, right? So I think we're at a moment where, like, there's both the sort of emergence of technologies and an awareness of kind of ecological issues that mean we're less human than ever, right? Or we're kind of worried about our humanity more than ever. At the same time, the internet, like, really emphasizes the author function. If you look at authors online, they're so much so present even in their kind of virtual world. You know, they're not decoupled at all. And I think autofiction is partly like trying to reclaim, like a last, like attempt to reclaim the kind of that authenticity. Yeah, you know, I put that in square quotes of the sort of author's relationship to their text.
Yeah.
And did you, when you were thinking about what's the inimitable thing, where is that, did you go in the sort of autofiction direction with that, or have you not sort of
I haven't this is a very recent thought. I don't know.
Would you consider fatherhood to be
imitable?
Autofiction.
I think so.
So maybe you're sort of without having thought about that problem, you're sort of already trying to occupy a space that a computer can't. I mean, I guess there's a difference between what's presented and the creative work that's gone into it. That's the other sort of thing. Well, a computer obviously can't ever write about fatherhood, can it? But it can produce a text about fatherhood. Mm-hmm. And it's that sort of Turing test thing, isn't it? About where if you read it and you think, well, it's completely plausible, then...
Well, there's also a thing about it. If a computer integrates many, many accounts of fatherhood... Is that a sort of richer description than one person who's limited by their own kind of solipsism?
I mean, there's a strong argument for that, I think, isn't
there? Yeah, it's whether what it's doing is sort of averaging to lower mean, or whether it's creating more profundity. I mean, ideally, you'd want something that could take all the high points and low points of every book written about fatherhood and turn that into something that had even higher peaks and lower troughs, but probably it's just going to
create just a trough.
Yeah.
Well, there's sort of cliches as well that will become embedded in that as well. Yeah. There'll be things that we don't think of as the obvious reference points, then we'll realise that when you aggregate all the words that we've thought about.
Yeah, that's true. Have you ever read a book called The Bestseller Code?
No.
That's a really fascinating read because that's an attempt using computers to sort of reverse engineer a bestseller. It uses an algorithm to read all of the bestsellers of the last 10 years and then come up with a set of principles, you know, if you want to... And it says, weirdly, it says that Dave Eggers' The Circle... it's called The Circle, isn't it? Is the like prototypical bestseller of the last 10 years or something.
Right.
Which is strange, isn't it? It's just analysing. But it's a sort of guide for humans based on what a computer says humans do.
Right.
It's quite a fascinating read, not necessarily for tips, but just to see what
analysis of
it. Yeah, exactly.
Because, yeah. Right. I mean, it does seem quite a different sort of almost a different process completely, writing a sort of bestseller compared with writing sort of experimental fiction. I mean, there's always overlap, but yeah, I wonder how, I mean, maybe computers are involved in completely different ways in both of them and going forward. And also like looking back and the development of writing and storytelling, at some point storytelling was just somebody sitting down or a group of people sitting down and telling a story. And as, you know, libraries and texts have become more prevalent, the idea of scholarship and referencing other stories that has been around for centuries. But at some point that wasn't a thing, I guess. I mean,
yeah.
And people have sort of integrated that into... You just sort of expect certain authors to have a certain level of scholarship that they're going to know and be aware of, even if they don't reference it within the text. And that's just part of writing now. And I wonder, in a similar way, that people would just be expected to know and integrate the tools of AI or whatever develops.
And I think what's interesting is a lot of my favorite books, a lot of W.G. Siebold or Borges are people, Wolf to a certain extent, whose texts are largely collages, or at least quite large. But they tend to be collages of existing literary texts, right? And texts which are kind of acknowledged as being in like a certain corpus. And I think what happens now is that just that corpus is just like, you know, massively expanded and across the literary and the non-literary.
Yeah.
And so there isn't necessarily a fixed reference point. It's not like, oh, here's the canon, and here's where, and you're kind of sitting on the top of that, you know. And for good reason, there are good reasons why we might not have that. But then it also just opens up this massive unknown territory.
And it changes that. You know, in Borges' time, it was possible to sort of reference a canon and to work with that in a way that you can't do now. But now there are other tools, and in the future there'll be even newer, different tools that create a different way of people understanding what a text is doing or how it interacts with other texts.
Yeah, one of the things I've thought about a bit with this book is what my daughter... I mean, I have two daughters, but this book was written in the wake of one daughter in particular, what she will think of when she reads this book. And I mean, I've thought a bit about the kind of personal stuff, but I hadn't thought about like what reading might mean to her in 20 years' time. Like what it might, maybe that she'll have quite different idea, but it might be that this is like a really antiquated kind of narrative.
Or it could be that fatherhood is one of 250 books that were fed into the hit series of 2055. And, oh, yeah. There's like two phrases from fatherhood appear in this hit TV show that was created from an amalgamation of 200 years of writing on topic of fatherhood. That might be what an author is. It? I've done well. I got in the 250.
That's where the royalties come from. Yeah. You can get a line into the hit TV show.
Thank you for listening. That was episode 27. And thank you to Caleb for joining us. You can find out more about Unsound Methods and listen to previous episodes at unsoundmethods.co.uk. Or do find us on Twitter and tell us what you think. We're at Unsound Methods.
It's handy, that one. Easy to remember. You can find out about me and my writing at jamiebatchin.com, on Twitter at jamiebatchin, or on Instagram at jamie_batchin.
And you can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com, or I'm on Twitter at lachlanbloom.
And we will put some information about Caleb and his writing under this episode with some links. There's some of his writing samples available, and Fatherhood is out now on Prototype.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Take care.